Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for November 29th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Very glad to have you with us today. The president is predicting a government shutdown. A senior House Democrat is facing pressure to resign over sexual assault allegations. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are trying to keep their heads down and stay on task because they're very close to passing a massive $1.5 trillion tax cut. Now, changes are still being made, and the Senate will then have to hash out differences with the House. But in the House, there is Republican consensus on one major proposal. Republicans, in their tax bill, want to repeal what's known as the Johnson Amendment. It goes back to 1954, and it prohibits churches and nonprofits from endorsing political candidates. The Johnson Amendment is really just one part of the social contract when it comes to religion and politics in America. Government is supposed to stay out of the church. Church is supposed to stay out of the government. But if the Johnson Amendment goes away, experts warn that tax-exempt charitable contributions to churches or other nonprofits could be used not for hospitals and for good works, but for campaign ads and opposition research. President Trump promised to repeal the Johnson Amendment just about 2 weeks after he took office.
I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
That's the president promising to totally destroy the Johnson Amendment at the National Prayer Breakfast back in February. Lori Goodstein is national religion correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. And Lori, when we talk about the Johnson Amendment, we're talking about Lyndon Johnson, who before he was president or vice president was a senator. What was the idea behind the Johnson Amendment? What was it supposed to do?
What it says is that if you are a nonprofit organization, and that includes charities, churches, also includes some hospitals and universities, you are limited from endorsing or opposing political candidates. You can't get involved in electioneering. It doesn't mean that you can't have a say on political issues or be public about where you stand on policies. It just means that you can't get involved in political campaigns. And then Senator Johnson, he introduced this because there were a couple of nonprofits that were going after him in his reelection. And this thing just walked into law. It was non-controversial. It became part of the law immediately, and it's been in place since 1954.
So, Lori, why do House Republicans want to undo this tradition now? Is it as simple as a gift to evangelicals in the GOP base who want to flex more muscle?
This is something that for about the last decade or a little bit more, certain clergy who are part of the organized, what I would call the religious right, and primarily conservative Christian clergy that are highly politicized, they have seen the Johnson Amendment as a limit on their free speech. And the truth is that it was a very weak limit. It was more of an inhibition than anything that would really have any consequences. If a minister preached in favor or opposed to a political candidate from the pulpit, there was the possibility that they could be reported to the IRS and that the IRS could investigate and potentially could take away their tax-exempt status. In reality, we know that happened only one time in all those years. So it was a very, very weak and barely enforced limitation. However, at a certain point in the 90s and then into the 2000s, the religious right latched on to this and made it an issue. And beginning in 2008, ministers got together and said, we're going to flaunt this rule and preach from the pulpit and send the tapes to the IRS and court prosecution, court case. And the IRS never really took the bait. It never really happened. So then they latched on to changing this legally. And it has come up. It's been introduced in legislation before now, but it never really took hold until now.
The group of ministers, I think you're talking about their political action from the pulpit. It was called Pulpit Freedom Sundays, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was organized by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a Christian legal organization.
And did they get the ear of President Trump when he was running for president? He very famously gave his ear to evangelical leaders when he became a Republican.
When he was beginning his campaign, he very intentionally courted Christian conservatives. And one of the issues they brought to him was the Johnson Amendment. We'd like to get rid of the Johnson Amendment. Now, in truth, this is a very widely unpopular move, even among clergy. Polls have shown that the vast majority of clergy want the Johnson Amendment to stay in place. What the Johnson Amendment does for them, it gives them cover. If someone is pressuring them to take political action or to make an endorsement of a candidate, they can say, look, I can't because of the Johnson Amendment. And it keeps their churches out of outright electioneering or getting involved in politics. And so polls have shown that even the majority of white and evangelical clergy don't want the Johnson Amendment changed. This is also very unpopular with the public. A poll released just yesterday by the University of Maryland found that nearly 80% of voters oppose the proposal that would allow churches and nonprofit organizations to endorse political candidates. So, you know, the only impetus for this is coming from a much narrower slice of the clergy.
Well, what would change in the real world if some of these ministers that you're talking about who want the Johnson Amendment repealed, ostensibly they can raise a lot of money. I'm going to guess that some of them have mega churches, not just churches. How would our politics look different, do you think, with the Johnson Amendment repealed? What kind of money are we talking about and what kind of influence?
Well, what you might begin to see is that people who now give their money to political organizations or to super PACs, and that money is taxed because those are not nonprofit organizations. If they know that a nonprofit is going to use their money for a political purpose or to get involved in a political campaign or, you know, support a candidate, they might instead give their money to that nonprofit organization. It won't be taxed. And not only that, the donors won't be revealed. So you can have all kinds of dark money flowing through nonprofits and churches. And that could change the very mission of these organizations.
Lori, could churches essentially pass the plate, as it were, or maybe more likely now, get you to PayPal them cash for a donation to the church and turn around and pour it into a candidate's campaign account? Could it be as simple as that?
Well, it can't happen now, but it could happen if the Johnson Amendment is revoked. Now, there are some limits in the way the legislation is written that says that only, you know, reasonable amounts. But the legislation doesn't make clear how this will work or what amounts we're talking about. So all bets are off.
Lori Goodstein with The New York Times. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you for having me.
Well, if House Republicans succeed in repealing the Johnson Amendment, it won't affect just religious organizations. Charities and other nonprofits are included, too, and many of them are nervous about the impact the tax overhaul could have. Ray Madoff is a law professor at Boston College and director of the Boston College Law School Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good. Ray, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you just heard us talking about the Johnson Amendment and the possibility that it could go away. Churches and nonprofits would be able to get directly political, endorse and spend on candidates, really jump into politics. What would this do to charities, in your view?
Well, this is a big problem for charities because what this does is it leaves them vulnerable to donors who want to exert their political speech through charities. Now they'll be able to make tax-deductible contributions to charities and, in some cases, pressure the charities to get involved in politics when they would prefer to stay out of the fray.
Well, the Johnson Amendment, Ray Madoff, is just one part of the gigantic tax overhaul bill that Republicans are contemplating here. Let's step into the tax code a little bit, because that's going to have a big impact on charities as well. One of the ways that congressional Republicans are helping pay for their tax cuts in this bill is by tinkering with deductions. What are they contemplating?
Right. Well, one of the big changes that they're contemplating is to increase the standard deduction. And what this does is currently individuals are able to either itemize their deductions or take the standard deduction, which is currently around $6,000. What both the House and Senate bill does is it significantly increases the standard deduction to $12,000. And the impact of this will be to make it such that the vast majority of Americans, about 95%, will no longer itemize their deductions. If they don't itemize their deductions, they will not get any tax benefits for their charitable giving.
Well, Ray Madoff, this is a little bit confusing because for decades, the GOP argument was that government shouldn't be redistributing wealth or running social programs. That's what charities are for. Hey, go to your local community, give to a charity. You shouldn't be paying higher taxes. These policies you're describing don't seem to support that idea.
That's what makes this policy particularly disappointing. The issue of support for charities is something on which there should be support by both Republicans and Democrats. Republicans like the idea of reducing the burdens on government. Democrats like the idea of promoting the work that charities do. And together, they should both be in support of trying to protect charities. However, this tax bill does the exact opposite. It really cuts charities off at the knees. It really harms charities in fundamental ways, and it's going to significantly affect their ability to do all the things that we count on charities to do.
Well, the Senate may pass their version of the tax overhaul this week, but there's plenty of negotiation to go. And Ray Madoff, you've said that there are three simple steps that lawmakers can take to save charities as they continue to negotiate. What can they do?
The first thing they could do would be to make the charitable deduction available for all taxpayers, regardless of whether they itemize. The second issue has to do with the Johnson Amendment, and I think that the best thing for charities and the things that charities want for themselves is to be able to focus on their charitable mission and not be pulled into politics. Therefore, the Johnson Amendment should be kept in its current form. The third issue has to do with the rise of donor-advised funds. This is something that is not covered in the current tax bill, but should be. It was covered in prior tax bills. In order for charities to be able to do their work, they need to have control over their charitable donations. What's happened in recent years is that a new form of charity has been popularized by the financial services industry. These are donor-advised funds, which are essentially accounts where donors get the charitable deduction for donating their money, but are still given ongoing control over the donated funds. Fidelity Charitable is the largest purveyor of donor-advised funds and has become the largest charity in the country. The problem is that there is no legal requirement that money ever come out of the donor-advised funds, so they can sit in those funds for decades or even longer, all the while they have been given the tax benefits, but the charities are not given access to the funds. So Congress should enact a rule that requires that contributions to a donor advised fund be paid out within a reasonable period of time. Something like 10 years would be reasonable.
So that it's not just a glorified tax shelter.
Absolutely. You don't want tax benefited dollars sitting in accounts not being available for charities to use in their missions.
Well, Ray Madoff, it's not easy to tell exactly when the tax bill will be finished, when the president might sign it, but it sounds like philanthropies and charities around the country are pretty nervous.
They're very nervous, and they should be because, unfortunately, the current tax proposals are really going to harm them in significant ways.
Ray Madoff, director of the Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good at Boston College, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's not that OxyContin is particularly powerful. It's that pain is particularly confounding.
Every single day, there's somebody gone, that there's somebody lost. So it almost feels like my Facebook is nothing but like an obituary at this point.
It's so important for the mental health and substance abuse issues to be treated together.
We have a number of ignorant people in control of our policy in the United States, and it is driving many of us bonkers.
There is an underground movement all across this country that is beginning to rise up.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's good to have you with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we continue now our ongoing coverage of opioid addiction in America. Victims of this crisis are not limited to drug users. Families are also devastated, children in particular, because when parents are struggling with addiction, children can be left in dangerous or unstable situations.
There was one point where, like, I was dope sick, and, like, I was laying on my couch, and my son actually wandered out of my house because, like, I was just so just like incoherent, and he wandered out of the house, was running up and down my street, and a neighbor actually had to bring him home.
You might remember Kimber, an opioid user in recovery, who we talked to a couple of weeks ago. Kimber's a mother in Massachusetts, and her story is like a lot of parents addicted to opioids. It's a crisis on the rise, not just in Massachusetts, but especially in Ohio, a state with one of the highest overdose death rates in the country. The foster care system in Ohio has become dangerously overextended, with too few foster families to cope with rising numbers of children who need care because they can't stay at home with parents who are addicted or who've overdosed. Let's go to Ohio now with Scott Britton, Assistant Director of Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, and also Cassandra Holtzman, JFS Child Services Director in Crawford County, Ohio. Scott, Cassandra, welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Scott, give us a sense of the scope of the problem here. What's happening in Ohio's foster system, and how is it connected to opioids?
Well, what we have seen since 2010 is a 22% increase in the number of children in custody, and just 10% increase in the past year only. So we attribute much of that increase to the opioid crisis. We did a survey of our members, including Cassandra in Crawford County, and found that in 2015, of all the children taken into custody that year, half of them had parental drug use as one of the removal factors, and 28% of the total had opioids in particular, whether it be prescription opiates or heroin or some analog of that at the time of removal.
And Scott, what do caseworkers typically see when they encounter a family where opioid addiction has hit home and kids aren't being cared for?
Well, our caseworkers very much act as first responders, similar to the police or the fire department. Sometimes they're first on the scene when there's an overdose. We've heard situations where caseworkers have had to tell a child that their parent has died in the next room. They are experiencing a lot of secondary trauma themselves because, unfortunately, these children aren't going home, or at least not going home as quickly as what they are accustomed to. A lot of our caseworkers really live to reunify these children with their parents. And what we've seen with this epidemic is that children are staying in custody much longer because of the cycle of recovery and relapse with heroin addiction. In fact, they're staying about a month longer in custody on average than they were in 2010. And it may not seem like a big jump, but a whole other month means possibly another birthday or another holiday away from home, and being removed to foster care is a traumatic experience for children.
Cassandra, can you describe, if you can, sort of the kid's eye view of addiction in their family, the trajectory for a kid when they're removed because of an addicted parent or guardian? What does a child go through once your caseworkers are on the scene and trying to look after their best interests?
Yeah, that's certainly something that, you know, it varies depending on the case. But the general case, I think, is children are really left in the wake. They're the silent victims of this epidemic. And so when a worker goes in, they're trying to remove the child from the trauma at the moment. And as Scott said, in the severe cases, they're having to explain things to children that a child really should never have to hear. But then once what we try to do at that point is to keep the trauma limited. So what we're trying to do is place a child with someone they're familiar with. We're looking for family members and relatives. Really, what we have to begin then is, does the child need treatment? Does the child need immediate care? And then following that, we have to begin work with the parents in order to reach reunification. So we're working in all different areas. But from the child's point of view, what has happened is their parent, unfortunately, has made a decision or has been the victim of this epidemic and has decided to choose drugs over their child. And the child, that's the way the child views it. We understand that this is a serious addiction, but the child doesn't see it that way. And they don't know what's really happened in the midst of all of this trauma. And so we're moving them, we're moving their belongings, taking them somewhere else. Their life is in upheaval. Now we have to work to help them put the pieces back together, whether that's through treatment or whether it's through working with them and their relatives to see that they're being parented. There's a whole host of responsibilities we have at that point. But this is certainly a strain for children.
Scott, this isn't the first time we've heard of parenting crises because of drugs, certainly alcohol. But is there something qualitatively different here with opioids? You mentioned that the numbers are up, I wonder if there's something fundamentally different than other drug waves, even alcoholism, that you encounter all the time.
Well, there's a lot going on with this epidemic. It started with prescription drugs and opiates. And I think a lot of us know that it affected white Ohioans and white Americans more than other previous drug epidemics had. And a lot of people are saying it got more attention because of that. And it's expensive for our system to work with these families. The scale of it is just really quite unbelievable here in Ohio. We lead the nation in the number of overdose deaths and the number of heroin overdoses and the use of synthetic drugs. And the cost to our children's services system is staggering. We've seen a $55 million increase in the placement costs to our agencies between 2013 and 2016. And Cassandra knows better than I do that Ohio relies more heavily on county funds to pay for children's services than any other state in the nation. And our agencies are struggling to pay the foster care and the residential costs for supporting these children.
Well, let's talk about some of that money, because Cassandra, I think 13 or maybe a dozen counties in Ohio passed levies where voters recognized the additional cost here and agreed to pay more to help with the opioid crisis. What did they pass in Crawford County, and what did it mean to your bottom line?
Well, basically, they really stepped up to the plate. I think the taxpayers certainly recognize what's going on in Crawford County. It was a 1.5 mil levy that just passed, and it's going to generate a little bit over $1 million a year. Our placement costs at this point are roughly, I believe in 2016, they were $1.6 million, a little bit over $1.6 million. So that will cover a significant portion of our placement costs. But this is definitely a serious help for Crawford County.
And behind all of those dollars, behind all of those levies, is a kid who doesn't have a drug-free home to live in.
Doesn't have a drug-free home, may not even have a parent left. And while we've seen that huge increase in kinship placements, a 62% increase over 6 years, and we prefer to place kids with kin, because of the generational nature of the heroin epidemic, sometimes it's hard to find a grandparent or an aunt or uncle who is clean and can take the children in. And so we have to resort to foster care or, as Cassandra mentioned, residential care for those children who have really been traumatized by the neglect that they've experienced.
Scott Britton is Assistant Director of Public Children's Services Association in Ohio. Scott, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
And Cassandra Holtzman, thanks to you as well. Cassandra is Crawford County JFS Child Services Director.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have been here.
It's great to have you with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. That smartphone you're carrying in your pocket right now, it's great. It lets you text, it lets you talk and tweet, it even lets you listen to our show. But while you're doing all of these great things, your phone is listening. It's recording. It's recording what you text, what you search, maybe what you buy, and definitely where you go. And if that makes you nervous, imagine how you'd feel about your phone once the cops got a hold of it. That's the very issue in front of the Supreme Court today, where justices are hearing a case that could decide whether the Constitution protects you from cops who want to search your phone without a warrant. A man named Timothy Carpenter was convicted of a series of crimes largely based on his cell phone location data. The thing is, police got those data without a warrant, and Carpenter says that violated his rights under the Fourth Amendment, protection against unreasonable search and seizure. There's a lot at stake in this case involving your rights and some of the biggest, most powerful companies in America. Jeffrey Rosen is president of the National Constitution Center. Jeffrey, great to have you back.
Great to be back.
Well, Jeff, tell us the story of Timothy Carpenter, what he was convicted of doing back in 2010 and 2011, and what it says about Fourth Amendment rights in the digital age.
Well, Timothy Carpenter was convicted of stealing cell phones, and he was caught using his cell phone. It's an amazing story. Basically, he was an armed robber. He was going around robbing Radio Shacks and stealing electronics. And in order to reconstruct his movements in public for 127 days, the police subpoenaed his geolocational records from his cell phone carrier. And when we walk around with our cell phones, we're pinging cell phone towers all the time that can trace our location within a block or two. And using this amazing amount of data, the police were able to figure out exactly where he'd been and to prove that he had indeed committed these robberies. So they indicted and convicted him. And he objected, this is an unconstitutional search because you did not have a valid search warrant before you seized my digital data. And the huge question before the Supreme Court, which could determine the future of digital privacy in the 21st century, is do we have an expectation of privacy in our digital data? Is it an unreasonable search or seizure of our digital effects, to use the language of the Fourth Amendment, when the police seize a huge amount of data without a judicial warrant?
Even if we allow a big corporation like Sprint or Verizon to own that data, that's part of the question here. Jeff Rosen, one might look at this and say, well, the cops search phone records and phone numbers all the time. Why is this different?
That's the central question in the case. In the 1970s, the Supreme Court held that when I make one telephone call, I abandon any expectation of privacy in that number because I know the phone company is recording that number. And that was a case called Smith versus Maryland, and it created something called the third party doctrine, which says that when I voluntarily turn over data like a phone number to a third party, I lose all expectation of privacy in it. The huge question in this case is, are a million phone numbers different than just one number, or are phone numbers that can reveal our locations in public with granular precision different from making a single phone call? And that is a case that the court has been grappling with in recent years. And the answer to that question is what makes this case so important.
So it's easy to understand why the FBI, why law enforcement agencies would want this power to easily search without a warrant. That makes sense. Who's on Timothy Carpenter's side here?
Well, Google and Microsoft and Apple and Facebook, all of the platforms that store all of our data say, hey, we don't want to be forced to turn over this incredibly private information to the government without a really good reason, like a judicial search warrant, or else citizens, consumers won't feel comfortable turning over their data in the first place. And other people who are on the side of Timothy Carpenter include civil libertarian liberals and libertarian conservatives who say, in an age when we store all of our data in the digital cloud, in third-party servers owned by companies, then if the court extends that doctrine to our digital data, we would literally have no privacy. It's this fascinating question of constitutional translation. At the time of the framing of the Constitution, the search that sparked the American Revolution were the general warrants and writs of assistance that allowed the king to rummage through people's private diaries. But in those days, you had to break into someone's home to search their diary. Now you can search the equivalent of a digital diary merely by seizing data turned over to third parties. So Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in a recent case involving global positioning system surveillance, said the court needs to reconsider this whole idea that we have no expectation of privacy in data stored with third parties, or else in the digital age, we will have no privacy.
I mean, Jeff Rosen, it's almost intuitive at this point. This isn't really about just cell phone tower location data or about Timothy Carpenter at all. I mean, the phones that we carry with us all the time contain a lifetime of data about us, who we talk to, what we say, where we go. This is really what it's about.
It's absolutely what it's about. And the Supreme Court seems to understand the stakes. In a recent case involving the question of whether the police can open our cell phones without a warrant when they arrest us, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote a unanimous opinion for all nine justices saying, our cell phones are the equivalent of our digital diaries. We live on our cell phones. Most Americans carry them. They can reveal the political rallies we attend or the people we associate with. To allow a search of our cell phones without really good reason would be the equivalent of the general warrants. And Chief Justice Roberts quoted John Adams as saying, at the moment that James Otis denounced the writs of assistance, at that moment, the child revolution was born. So the justices seem to understand the stakes of digital privacy. And what makes this case so fascinating and really important is it's possible the court could decide it narrowly or broadly or punt it, but the answer is going to have huge consequences for the future of digital privacy.
And we're expecting a decision in June. But Jeff Rosen, you know, on its face, it's a little bit hard to imagine the justices not ruling that you need a warrant to search these records. I mean, no one is saying police can't search geolocation data. They're just saying you need a warrant for it, just like you need a warrant to knock down the door.
Absolutely. Under something called the Stored Communications Privacy Act, you're allowed to get data if you have reasonable suspicion that the data is relevant to a criminal investigation. The cops invoke that law in trying to seize this data. And the only limit that the court would impose here is to say, if you're going to seize a huge amount of data that can reveal a tremendous amount about us, then you need a judicial warrant. Now, the difficulty of the case is, where do you draw the line? Everyone agrees that you can seize a day worth of data, or the police can follow you on the street for a day. Here, Timothy Carpenter is saying, you can't follow me for 5 months. And figuring out when the magic line kicks in is something that the court is going to have to decide.
And Timothy Carpenter himself, does he stand to have his case overturned if the justices rule in his favor?
He was sentenced to a tremendously long amount of time in prison, I think more than 100 years. And it's possible that even if this case is overturned, it may not be that he gets out of prison for other reasons. But his case will absolutely set huge precedents that really could determine the future of privacy for lots and lots of people.
The Fourth Amendment, your right against unreasonable search and seizure by the government, at stake in the United States Supreme Court in the digital age. Jeff Rosen with the National Constitution Center. Jeff, thanks as always.
Pleasure, as always.
Thanks for being with us today. It's Todd Zwillick, and we're looking at the future of the political parties in America all this week and next. Now, next week, it's the GOP. And Republicans, remember, we want to hear from you on the state and the future of your party. So call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But this week, the Democrats. Howard Dean has been on the inside of Democratic politics for decades. He was a six-term governor in Vermont, a presidential candidate in 2004, and chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2005 until 2009. Now, Dean is known among Dems for arguing the party shouldn't give up the South or the Midwest, that it should play in all 50 states. Well, now, Howard Dean says it's time for his generation to move over, and he says Democratic wins in Virginia earlier this month prove it.
Our most important age group is under 35. And the stats in Virginia were unbelievable. Between the ages of 18 and 30, 69% of people voted Democratic. Now, that's a number you don't see that number among age group demographics. So I think it was a very big deal for the Democrats, partly because we have to realign as the Republicans do. And the Virginia election this year was a big piece of that.
All right, the Virginia results are great if you're a Democrat, Governor, but are you sure that the reckoning's going really, really well? I mean, couldn't those results in Virginia be about a party divided, the Republicans, and a president leading that party somewhere around 34%, and you better win, you know?
Given the, we can't control what Trump is and does, but what we can control is getting the effort out, raising the money, most importantly, recruiting young people. So, yeah, sure, Trump gave us an assist, but the real important piece was the recruiting and the turnout of millennials, or first globals, as I call them, into the political process, and they meant it. Now, there's some problems. We're going to have a lot of problems still. We have to figure out what kind of an institution they want to join. They're not going to join the DNC, and they're mostly not even consider themselves Democrats, but they vote with us all the time because our values are the same.
So then how important is it for the DNC, for the Democrats who plan the primaries and the caucuses, to open up that process? Look, with the inside baseball, there's a big debate inside the DNC now, Governor, which I know you're familiar with, about what it means to be a Democrat in the future and whether Democrats need to be more open to independents or people without a D next to their name. You seem to be saying, yes, they better be.
Yes, they better be, but let's not do this in a hypocritical manner to benefit the interests of the current candidates or possible candidates. If it's a good thing to open up our primaries to independents, it's also a good thing to get rid of the caucuses, which are incredibly undemocratic. You can't vote if you're infirm, if you have two jobs, if you're a soldier. You can't vote absentee. So let's democratize the party, not as a part of the Hillary versus Bernie fight, which I wish would people would shut up, because we got to look towards 2020 and 2018 and not backwards. But let's really democratize the party. And by the way, democratizing the party does not mean getting rid of the superdelegates. The superdelegates are there for a reason. We democratized the party the last time and got rid of the people who are superdelegates. None of the elected officials went to the convention. The way to deal with superdelegates, if you want to make it more democratic, is not to get rid of them. It's simply to bind them in the same percentage so that they have to vote in the same percentage their states did. That's the fair way to do it and the smart way to do it.
Look, you were always a big proponent when you ran the DNC and even before of not having a Democratic Party that was a regional party. You said all 50 states, let's run credible candidates in 50 states, let's raise money in all 50 states and compete in all 50 states, you know, even Arkansas, a place where Democrats haven't won since Bill Clinton. What's the future of that? Is it the economic message? Is it the populist, progressive Bernie Sanders message that's going to do that for Democrats?
It is a version of that. Here's what you have to understand about our target group, which is the young people of this country. They are socially very, very liberal, would be called in today's jargon, but I think actually conservative and liberal are now inoperative. For this generation, they value human rights and social justice, but they also value libertarian economic policies. So there is a disconnect even in the older leadership and the old way of sort of looking at the left and the new way. The new way has a narrower bandwidth ideologically. They're more conservative about economics, say, than the left wing of the Democratic Party, but that is overridden and will be for some time because of the far-right social policies of the Republican Party. It makes it impossible for young people to vote for Republicans.
Republicans in general elections at the same time, Governor, get very excited about the prospect of highlighting some of the social agenda of members of the Democratic coalition. You know, it's fine in a Democratic primary. It's fine when liberals fight it out over racial identity or gender identity, things like this. I think Republicans think they salivate for general elections when they can still paint Democrats as beholden to some groups that maybe moderate Midwestern voters just don't connect to.
Look, we are who we are. We're certainly not going to abandon racial justice. We're not going to abandon social justice. We're not going to abandon women's rights. We're not going to abandon gay rights. We're not going to abandon our notion of an optimistic America moving forward, including everybody. And I would remind my conservative friends that capitalism fails unless everybody gets included. I'm for capitalism. It's the best, most efficient system we've ever had. But if it's not going to succeed, we will kill capitalism if we exclude people as we are currently doing. This tax bill, for example, is a joke. It favors all the people who already have billions of dollars and takes money from the middle class in order to pay for it, including attacking Medicare, which I think is insane. I mean, I can't make up my own mind whether the Republicans are worse off if it passes or better off if it passes. Because if it does pass, we're going to kick their butts in 2018. And if it doesn't pass, they have to answer all the questions from inside the Beltway about how come they didn't get anything done. This is just stupidity, this tax bill that they're doing. And they did it with health care. I do not know what this Republican Party is doing, but they certainly seem to me to be pushing the self-destruction button.
Well, look, that self-destruction in the Republican Party, to the extent that it's going on, and the president's unpopularity, has to help Democrats to some degree, Governor. But do you think that Democrats are doing enough right now to give voters a positive reason to go Democratic? The base always will. Moderates might be turned off to Donald Trump, but Democrats tell me all the time it's not enough to have Donald Trump at 34. Democrats need a positive message and a place where voters really want to go.
In 2020, that's true. But in 2018, it's wishful thinking and inside the Beltway, which is synonymous with completely out of touch with reality, writers and politicians. So here's the story. Look at the facts. The facts are in 2010, we got our you-know-what's kicked because President Obama was not popular. We lost 67 seats. The only item on the ballot was whether President Obama was popular or not. So in 2018, having Donald Trump being much more unpopular than President Obama was, is going to work just fine for us. It will not work in 2020. You cannot have a candidate. This past election was somewhat of an exception. But you cannot have a candidate win without a positive message. It's not just about how awful Trump is. That's going to help because he's an incumbent. What we really have to have is a positive message. I have firmly said again and again and again, I would like to run a candidate for the presidency who is under 50, but I'll settle for under 55. We need a young candidate who's going to talk about this next generation, this first global generation. And so I'm very hopeful that somebody like that will emerge. And it'll be against the odds because there are going to be some people in my generation who will run. I think that's fine. I think they're great people. I think our time has come and gone in my generation.
So, Howard Dean, it sounds like your prescription for 2018 is Democrats can skate on the unpopularity of President Trump, but then in 2020, they're going to need a presidential candidate and an identity who's under 55, and what else? Who is that person?
It could be anybody. Our electorate, our core, the kids, the young people under 35 who elected Barack Obama president, first time in my life, only time in my life, where in 2008 where more people under 35 voted than over 65. Those folks are going to choose a candidate, and I want them to see candidates that look like them. They loved Barack Obama because he was multicultural, and this generation believes they're multicultural. So it could be a wide variety of people. I have four candidates that I talk about. So it would be Chris Murphy from Connecticut, Kamala Harris from California, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York. The last one is Eric Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles. Those are four candidates who I think would be really interesting and each attractive in their own way to the core constituencies of our party. But there are others. There are plenty of other really good candidates. Some of Seth Moulton is talking about it. Cory Booker is talking about it. There's lots of people, young people, that are talking about running for president. And I think that's great. And that is what we need. I fully expect to have 10 or 15 people at the starting line. And the question is, can they raise the money? Can somebody in that generation raise the money? And I don't know what the answer to that is, and we're going to find out.
Now, Governor, if we bring it back to the sort of the internal debates going on with the DNC now that most of the public really doesn't attend to, and I guess they shouldn't, there is a huge argument, as you know, going on between those Bernie supporters, those progressives, and the establishment wing of the Democratic National Committee. And it's not just an argument, because those Bernie supporters say, and they tell reporters all the time, that if they don't get their concessions here, if they don't see a Democratic Party that's more open to their priorities, they're gone, that they're going to pull all of their chips right out of the Democratic coalition and continue running independent candidates from the outside. And
guess
if you're
what?
A Democrat, that's not going to be good.
Guess what? They don't have any say. The truth is, the people who talk like that are a very small percentage of the Bernie coalition. 80% of Bernie's voters voted for Hillary. And there are some people who are older, who are what I call the sourpuss party. That is, they really actually don't want to win. What they really want to do is complain from an armchair and continue to be perfect while the world isn't. I'm interested in people, and I think the vast majority of Bernie supporters, while disappointed, worked really hard for Hillary because they knew that Hillary Clinton, as Bernie himself said, would be a whole lot better president than Donald Trump. So I think that fighting inside the DNC is a waste of time. It's a waste of everybody's time. And what I say to everybody is, get with the program. We have got to build a country that we can be proud of and build a country that our children can be proud of. They're going to do a lot of the building. We should stop already in this tempest in a teapot and stop litigating the last election. There were plenty of wrongs of all sorts. Stop litigating the last election and start working on the next election. If you care about the public, if you don't care about the public and your warrants and yourself and your own self-aggrandizement, be my guest, but don't get in my way.
Governor Howard Dean of Vermont, former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, on the future of the Democratic Party and that very Democratic National Committee. Governor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. President Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Health and Human Services appears in front of senators today to face questions before he can be confirmed. Alex Azar was president of the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly until January. President Trump picked Azar to replace Tom Price, who resigned from the cabinet in September. Juliet Alperin is senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. Juliet, what makes Alex Azar an attractive choice for President Trump and the GOP to head HHS?
He's an experienced federal servant as well as someone steeped in the health industry and the pharmaceutical industry. So it's a break from tradition in the sense that traditionally when a president is picking someone to head the Health and Human Services, they either pick someone from academia or from politics. Instead, this is someone who most recently was a top official in the pharmaceutical industry. He was president of Eli Lilly USA for several years. And before that, he was a top-ranking political appointee under George W. Bush at HHS, where he served first as general counsel from 2001 to 2005, and then as deputy secretary, the number two person in the department, until stepping down in 2007.
Now, he's an agency insider, but Juliet, Tom Price got ousted for flying around on private jets. But before that happened, he was an active critic of the Affordable Care Act, not just at HHS, but when he was in Congress, too. And the agency under Tom Price's direction made moves to discourage ACA enrollment, lots of them, even undermined enrollment efforts. What can we expect from Alex Azar?
We can certainly expect in many ways a continuation of the Trump policy on the Affordable Care Act. Azar has also been critical of the ACA. He's talked about how it's circling the drain earlier this year. And so it's not as if he's someone who's going to come in and seek to prop up the law. At the same time, he has suggested that there are ways that the administration can use its executive authority to address the law if it fails to pass a repeal through Congress. And so that's, again, one of the reasons he might be attractive to the White House.
Well, Juliet, we spend a lot of time talking about the Affordable Care Act, but HHS is home to a lot of ideologically hot programs and fights in the background. Reproductive rights, including contraception and abortion, adoption, medical research, including stem cell research at NIH. Does Alex Azar have positions on those?
Yes, although it's a little less articulated than some of these other things. One thing I do think is interesting is reproductive rights, and that's something you're going to see him being grilled on by Democrats. When it comes to the issue of abortion, for example, he's been endorsed by the Susan B. Anthony list, a very prominent anti-abortion political action committee. And so I think that's an area where he's going to come under scrutiny, but may not shy away from talking about his opposition to abortion.
Well, he's a former drug company executive, as you mentioned, at Eli Lilly. Lots and lots of Democrats, at least, would love to see the government negotiating on behalf of Medicare for lower drug prices. President Trump, as a candidate, made some nods towards that policy. I don't know if Alex Azar is going to be for that.
Historically, he has not really endorsed that idea, but I think what you're going to see is he is the president's nominee, and we should get more clarity in the coming days on that. I would be shocked if he staked out a different position from the president, given that it's been a priority for President Trump in the White House. And so I think we're going to see him talking about that in part because it is something that matters both to Republicans and Democrats.
And what are the regulators in the back halls of the Food and Drug Administration saying about this former Eli Lilly executive who could become their boss?
Well, you know, we haven't heard as much from folks inside the agency, but I think in general, people see him as someone who may be more skilled in dealing with both rank and file employees, as someone who helped oversee them for so long in a previous administration, and someone who has, in some ways, ironically, a better chance at working with Capitol Hill, even though his predecessor came from the House of Representatives.
Juliet Alperin with The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, that's all for us today. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.